She is not only a teacher, she is a writer and a very good friend to me and to all her students. There is a saying that a teacher opens the door, but the student must walk through. This fabulous teacher has the ability not only to open the door, she guides her children, her students through. Once they have been to one of her classes, they just hurry back. They're so anxious to get back, to learn from her, and it is truly an experience. I know this from my personal experience. I have taken a class from Mrs. Chater for the sheer fun of reading short stories. Within 2 weeks, she had me hooked on something I had never read before, that I would never waste my time with. It was science fiction. From that time on, I have read nothing but science fiction. Because she showed to me the great philosophical, religious, true meaning in science fiction. She not only is creative, but she was very instrumental in having the Department of English Literature here on the campus develop a section for the students who were interested in creative writing. This has really helped the university move forward. To show you how influential she is, when she was a student here at State, she convinced the graduate department that she should be able to write a creative work for her master's thesis. This was back at a time when this did not happen very often. The result of her convincing them that she had the creative ability to write resulted in one of the most beautiful novels. I thought you all would like to see it. I brought it tonight. This is the master's thesis of Mrs. Elizabeth Chater, an absolutely beautiful novel entitled The Mask of Kunti. Fabulous religious philosophical meanings in this novel. It shows her great background. She was born in Canada, where her parents gave her the wonderful opportunity of reading anything she liked in their library. She did not have to read just children's books. She could read anything. And thus, her literary background started. She traveled in the Far East with her parents, becoming very interested in the religions of the Far East. Fortunately for us, she settled in San Diego, has been teaching here at San Diego State for quite a few years, who has such a following that her classes are jammed. People are hanging from the chandeliers just to listen to her. She is absolutely fabulous. Someone to whom I introduce to you with great love, Mrs. Elizabeth Chater.
Share with you just the incorrigible teacher. hope that you will avail yourselves, if you wish to, of the opportunity later to come and see some of them. Most of them are firsts, and they are part of a collection which I am having the great honor to present to our library on the occasion of my graduation. I don't call it retirement because there's so much coming up that the word retirement just doesn't fit. But when I graduate from San Diego State University next June, I'm to have the privilege of bestowing upon Lou and the rest of you my, it's a little over 3,000 volume collection of fantasy, science fiction, and myth and associated materials. A very loving collection which I have been working on for the past 50 odd years. And this is something that I hope the students will enjoy sharing and will get as much fun out of it as I have. Now, in order to justify in whatever measure I can that introduction, I will celebrate with you this evening my great admiration for the fantastic experience in literature. Richard Blackmer, a quite good critic, has said that criticism is the formal discourse of one who loves. And I like that. I was searching for some definitions to begin this with, and that was appealing to me. And I thought, at least I have enough love for fantastic literature to qualify me for half of a critic. And then Blackmer went on to say, when there is enough love and enough knowledge represented in the discourse, it is a self-sufficient art. So I'll supply the love, and the rest of you can help me with the knowledge. One of the things that rather dismays any lover of a special art, and in this one, the art of writing fantastic literature, is that devoted authors of it are springing up all over the place like crabgrass, and they are turning out a flood. No, it's worse than that. It's a gully washer of material every year. Even the Saturday Review of Literature had to admit that there is a fantasy boom going on among adult readers. And since one could never hope to keep up with the literally thousands of new books and short stories in that genre, the fantastic literature genre, every year, all we can do, all I can do, is pursue, faint but determined, to try to keep up with what's coming off the presses. And this wonderful kind of a truth began to emerge as I thought about this boom in fantasy writing. This seems to me as vital and as exciting as what happened in the 1500s in England, when we had Marlowe and Decker and Webster and Fletcher and Ford and Shakespeare. It was a nova, to use a science fiction term. It was an explosion of talent. And the same thing, as you all know, happened in the 1700s in England, when that innovative and challenging little upstart, the novel, made its appearance. You know better than I do. I see so many experts here tonight, the men and women to whom I pay such deep respect that I feel a bit of a fool standing up here telling you all about it when you all know more than I do. But you helped me celebrate the joy of it anyway, so that's what we'll do. The flood of fantastic fiction, which is being published today, you will have other names for it. The apologists in the group like to call it a speculative fiction because that is more elegant than science fiction. It doesn't have the connotations of Buck Rogers and Spider-Man. We call it speculative fiction. We call it premise fiction. We call it fantasy. And of course it is. And I think it has a great deal in common
with these other two great explosions of creativity as a genre whose time has come. There's a good deal, well, rightness is all, and there's a good deal in the time for a thing is now. And a little later, I want to make a comment, if I remember to do it. I'm so excited about this good opportunity to share with you that I may not even remember, but someone will remind me. I think that there's something very interesting in that, that the time has come for fantasy and speculative fiction. These are the new myths. Plop into the mind. Oh, I'm so sorry. Can't you hear anything?
No,
oh, well, heavens, all those marvelous things I've already said. I have to go back over it. Well, briefly, I said then, I thought that I would compare the marvelous outreach and explosion of creativity which we are observing in the field of fantasy and speculative fiction with those other great outbursts in Shakespeare's London and in the England of Fielding and Richardson. A genre whose time has come. Now, with the fact of this great creative outburst comes also the weaknesses and the faults and the excesses of a new form, a burgeoning new art form. And we who are lovers of the field are willing to admit that there is much that is inferior, and it's such an enormous flow and speed that it can't all be superior work. But then how many Shakespeare's were there after all? And so we console ourselves with that. Even Shakespeare, and this is one of the consolations that we have, was called by his best friend, the comment was made by Johnson that he had small Latin and less Greek. And of course, small Latin and less Greek was a pretty serious critical comment at that time. And so if even the Greek ones, and you know that the critics of his time lumped all the playwrights with the players and called them those vagabonds, those vagrants, those...
What is this lovely phrase here?
Loose, idle, and disorderly persons. One of the comments which parallels that is one which was made by a very... I don't want to be rude. It was made by a critic who said to Mr. Theodore Sturgeon, who is one of the young writers in this field, "You know, of course, that 95% of science fiction is," and then he used a very unscholarly rude word, which I will not soil this microphone with, to which Mr. Sturgeon, rattling in, gave us a pedal, as we say in Regency England, rattled back and said, "Well, sir, you know that 95% of all fiction is..." I must say also that although, and I must not do anything but praise the leadership which is given on the faculty here, you are very fortunate. I see faculty members here whom I'm so proud to call my colleagues and who have done so much to encourage me and to make the study of literature a dazzlingly exciting thing. And I wouldn't be standing here today were it not for people like John Theobald and Claude Shells, and bless them. They're doing the things that you want them to do with your students. They're making this an exciting experience. And I'm here because of them. So it's your blame now. Blame for it. Yes, there has been poor stuff in any great outburst like that. There will be things which are less than literature. always, from all through all the periods, has a way of remaining. And I think with Arnold Bennett that one of the reasons why good things, why classics become classics, is because there is, there are both cliques, and that band, that means bands, band clubs, cliques and plaques. People who, that's a very difficult phrase to say into a microphone, cliques and plaques. People who are passionately devoted to the field, or to special authors, or to special genres. You know, of course, about the J-Nights. You've all heard about the J-Nights, Kipling's phrase for the people who loved Jane Austen and just wouldn't let her work be lost or slighted. And of course, starting with Sir Walter Scott, who said the doodly boo-boo, but she did the beautiful little cameo exquisite portraits, and through Kipling. And you know, too, that there were at least two prime ministers of England who were proud to call themselves J-Knights. And I think many of you may be members of groups like the Royal Society, fan clubs, like the Robert Burns Society, and some of you might even be members of the Baker Street Irregulars. I'm not sure whether you are or not. Or even some of you might be Trekkies. They're all cliques and plaques, and they refuse to let the things die which they love and believe in. Now, how is it then, this ardor of the passionate few, how do they manage to convince the rest of us that this is an experience really worth having? Well, they talk about it. They get themselves invited to elegant dinners, and they talk about it, and they sell it, and they read it with relish, and they savor it, and they buy copies for their friends. They gift their friends and relatives ad nauseum. And we talk about it, and we talk about it. And one day, through sheer exhaustion probably, the unhooked members, the great majority, suddenly decide that there may well be something in this silly new form, and perhaps we'll have a look at it. And at that point, Arnold Bennett, rubbing his hands gleefully in the background, we may be starting some classics on their way to recognition. Now, how do you differentiate between what is good and valuable and worthy of living in a new field like this, and what is chaff, what isn't worth recalling or preserving in any way? Well, I suppose the only thing you can do is use your critical judgment and say, how do you tell when anything is a good piece of writing? And you know, there are five tests that you apply. You decide whether the characters are living, breathing beings with whom you can identify, in whose sorrows and challenges you can become involved emotionally, characters that you care about, characters you wish to see succeed, characters who are dimensional enough so that even if they fail, you can say, well, you made a good try, and I'm proud to be in the same universe with you, because you enlarge mankind by the effort you make. If there are characters like that, in science fiction fantasy, then perhaps we should be looking at it seriously. And I feel there are. Then there is action, which is absorbing, suspenseful, so that we want to know what happened. We can't wait. We want to turn to the last page quickly and see how it all came out. And when an author has that quality, we say he is a natural born storyteller, and we want to read more of it, because we're all children at heart. We all want to hear how it was once upon a time. All right. Then are the themes, are the ideas, the philosophical concepts, the truth about life, are they available? Are they there in science fiction and fantasy? do the authors give us insights into what it's like to be a man on earth, or a woman on earth, or a woman on a spaceship, or a woman on a foreign planet, an alien planet? And that brings me to the next one, settings. Are the settings fascinating? Are they exotic? Do they enhance the mood and atmosphere of the story? And I must say that science fiction has some fabulously exciting settings, as has fantasy. Who doesn't want to wander through Middle Earth? Oh, what a wonderful place to be. And so we say, we are homesick for these alien scenes, for this alien Earth that we haven't walked upon. And yet we can feel homesick because the settings are so beautifully done. All right? The fifth one, side. You see how well my teacher taught me? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I know them all. Character, action, setting, theme and style. Style has been, I think, one of the critical judgments. A lack of style has been one of the critical judgments made against much fantasy and science fiction. That the stuff was illiterate. That may have been so in some places at some time. But recently, I think you would be surprised to see what's happening in this field. I must register one complaint. One of my colleagues, not here, he would never be here. Why should they even mention the sex? This colleague would never be at a group like this, so this tells you something. Said to me one day in the corridor, I suppose you're going to teach some more of that science fiction next semester. With such a sneer. And of course, science fiction is a lovely word to sneer on. And I said, well, I intend to study some of the novels of Ursula Le Guin and some of the others. And he said, oh, trash, trash, trash. That's another good scornful word. And I said, have you, this was a mean blow, but I was pushed into a corner. And I said, have you read The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin? And he said, oh, no. Oh, no. I never read that kind of trash. So much for the critical stance. How do you know if you haven't read it? I felt like saying. But we were both past one another, thank goodness, so I wasn't tempted to violence. All right, now I have given quite a lengthy, and my daughters are crying to give me the signal when I'm going too long, because I know this. I've taken a clack in myself, and I could go on for several hours. So you're not to worry though, because I won't be permitted to. What is? We have three questions to ask ourselves, and I can give you the answers. I hope fairly briefly tonight. What is fantastic literature? How long have we had it with us? Where does it come from? Has it got any kind of a history at all? Any kind of a reputable genealogy at all? And finally, what good does it do us? Since this is one of the questions which I'm sometimes asked, you know, why bother with it? What good is it? All right. All fiction is divided into roughly three kinds. Mimetic, which imitates life as closely as possible, since all fiction is fantastic, isn't it? Because there really never was a David Copperfield, closely, though we may feel that we know him and care about him. And there never was a Tess of the D'Urbervilles. So all fiction is fantastic. But there is the kind of fiction which imitates life, which tries not to outrage any logical or physical sets that we may have, and is therefore called mimetic. And then there is what we call speculative fiction or premise fiction, in which one assumption is permitted,
H. G. Wells story, The Man Who Made the World Stand Still. I hope you've read that. That is delightfully funny. Well, I mustn't get taken off into any wander into any delightful digressions and so on. One falsity is permitted to be assumed. Man can fly without wings just by wanting to, or birds can talk, or animals can talk very nice English, very grammatical English. And once you have accepted this premise, then from then on, the story is required to proceed according to the laws of human physics, of human logic, and so on. And this is premise fiction. And then there's dream fiction, which is the kind of thing that Kafka did so well, where you're not sure just what universe you are in, or what is happening, or why, or anything about it. And these are the three kinds of fiction. And interestingly enough, science fiction and fantasy fit in all those fields. They are written in all those various kinds of literature. But precisely the kind of thing that's happening is fivefold. There are, first of all, five categories of science of fiction which deliver to us a fantastic experience in the sense in which I am now using the word, as not mimetic, but as premise or dream. There are myths, fairy tales, folk tales, and you've known about those all your lives. Everything from Puss in Boots to Orpheus and Eurydice. Everything from Cinderella to Alibaba to Hercules to Cain. Then, these myths and fairy tales have a very important task, and I think I should just mention it briefly if I could take a second to do it. That primitive man needed this. He was in a universe which was so much faster, so much more powerful, so little under his control, that he needed to get some kind of security. And so the great myths evolved in which man was able to come to terms with these forces, to placate the gods, to control this environment in some way, so that he could live in it, in his world, with courage and with some serenity. And so the myths are very important. And I'll come back to that once very briefly at the end. The second category of fantastic fiction is ghost stories, the supernatural, the occult, and those we've had with us since the dark cave and the firelight in the mouth of the cave, so that the ghosties and the beasties and the things that go bump in the night won't get in and hurt us. So this is another very ancient and honorable tradition in fantastic literature. And then we have, as man becomes more sophisticated and begins to feel that he's controlling his world, we have fable and allegory and example and parable. And we start using literature to teach, detecting, and monitoring the kind of teaching which spells out the myths for us. If you do certain things, don't be a dog in danger. Don't be the greedy dog with the bone. Because if you drop your bone in order to seize the other one down in the water, you'll end up with another one. So this is an example of fables. And these are not really, we didn't see a dog doing this, or a fox going after the grapes and so on. We didn't see that happen. But we accept it because it tells us the truth about lives, about our lives and about ourselves. And then the fourth kind of fantastic literature is what we now call fantasy. And we have simply delightful premise and dream fiction being written by people like when he was writing it for us, Tolkien, and his beautiful Middle-earth, and people like Evangeline Walton doing it now, with her lovely Welsh and Irish lyrics, myths. They are lyric. I didn't mean to use that word, but I was thinking of her lovely lyric style. So elegant, so typically British, ancient British. And we have people doing that, and then we have that fantastic man up in the north of California.